Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to Solving the Puzzle with Dr. Datis Karazian, informing you about evidence-based strategies for autoimmune disease, brain health issues, Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, gut health problems, and many other chronic health conditions. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at drknews.com.
For the hormone web, we want to start with these interactions between mitochondria, adipocytes, which is cells in body fat that are highly metabolic active, the adrenal glands, dysglycemia, the microbiome, the thyroglobulin, and the brain. And one of the most important things is the mitochondria. And when you look at mitochondria is obviously responsible for producing energy. If you remember the oxidative phosphorylation pathways, the goal of the mitochondria is to take, you know, food we eat, protein, fats, and carbs that eventually get converted into glucose that then get into the TCA cycle, tricyclic acid cycle, that then gets oxidized phosphorylation to go through these complex enzymes 1 through 5 to make ATP. And this is important for energy production throughout the cells, or basically general function of all cells. And this can manifest in fatigue issues. This can manifest in recovery issues, whether we're talking about muscle mitochondria or brain mitochondria or cardiac mitochondria or organ mitochondria. It really doesn't make any difference. But hormones have a tremendous impact on mitochondrial function. And when you look at the mitochondria itself and look at mitochondrial physiology, the mitochondria are involved with producing energy. But over a period of time, mitochondria, as they produce energy, go through this oxidative phosphorylation pathway to transfer these phosphate groups. That oxidative part of the phosphorylation part of it creates free radicals that actually damage the mitochondria itself. So over a period of time, there's accumulated damage to the mitochondria that produces energy, and then as more and more damage take place, the mitochondria become less efficient. And then what has to happen is that part of the mitochondria has to basically break off through fission, and then mitophagy has to take place where the mitochondria is cleared out of the system. And if this mitophagy pathway, this clearance pathway, doesn't work efficiently, then there's only so much room in each cell, and then you have less efficient mitochondria in that cell space, and then cell function goes down. So it's really important to have not only development of mitochondria, which is mitochondrial biogenesis, over a period of time, but basically to go through this process of making the mitochondria and then basically clearing it out. So your mitochondria, biogenesis, hormones are involved with the biogenesis part of it. Then there's accumulation, and then part of this mitochondria has to fuse off to the dysfunctional part, to the healthy part. The healthy part has to then grow, and that's this cycle. Now, lots of different studies have shown clear relationships between different types of hormones and mitochondrial function. This is a study looking at surrogate markers for mitochondrial function like VO2 max and testosterone. You can see the higher testosterone levels, the higher mitochondrial VO2 max. Here you can see another surrogate mitochondrial marker, UQ-CRB, and you can see as testosterone levels go up, greater mitochondrial function here as well. And just to summarize the literature on all these different pathways, the key things are thyroid hormones and reproductive hormones have a major impact in each of these different pathways. When you look at normal circadian rhythms, the ability to wake up, sleep, the normal rhythms of just even menstrual cycle rhythms, these things are really critical for mitophagy and fission. Fission is breaking off the debris part of the mitochondria needs to be cleared out. And rhythms are also, normal circadian rhythms like cortisol and melatonin are also really important for mitochondrial biogenesis, the formation of mitochondria. Now, estrogens play a huge role in mitochondrial biogenesis. Testosterone has a major impact on biogenesis. Progesterone has an impact on these. So when you look at the reproductive hormones like estrogens, progesterone, testosterone, they have a huge impact on development of mitochondria, raising levels of mitochondria, antioxidants, so they're protective. And also you have things like thyroid hormones, which then activate the metabolic rate that involve with energy production. So overall, one of the devastating things that takes place when people end up with hormone deficiencies is they have mitochondrial insufficiency. These pathways become compromised. And it's not uncommon to see people that have, males that have testosterone dysfunction, whatever under chronic disease they have, they can't get out of. until the testosterone levels get normalized or improved. You can have females that have endocrine disorders, hormone deficiencies. They can't get out of their endocrine dysfunction until they heal and recover. Like, you can have a person that has, I'll give you an example. You have a person that's like a female patient, they have chronic leaky gut, and they can't fix their leaky gut no matter what they do. And when you check their hormones, they're just low. They don't make any estrogen, they don't make any progesterone, the levels are extremely low. And it turns out they're like underweight, they're protein deficient, they don't have enough fats in their diet, and there isn't a chance for them to recover. They can take all the different glutamine and leaky gut formula products in the world, but there's just certain precursors that have to take place for them to make hormones, and hormones are then necessary to help regenerate the mitochondria of their intestinal cells to be able to proliferate and grow and regenerate. So this is like the effects of these mitochondrial involvements. Now, when you look at a paper that I published reviewing all the different main mechanisms that have been shown to impact mitochondrial function for each one of these steps, like mitochondrial biogenesis and antioxidant protection and mitophagy and fusion, and you could have different effects of these based on what other variables and factors are there. For example, when you look at making mitochondria, so you have ultimate cellular function and recovery and repair and all those things, hormones can have a huge impact on that. But also, if someone has lack of exercise, lack of cognitive stimulation, excess calories, estrogen or testosterone deficiencies, lack of anti-inflammatory flavonoids, these can make these things worse. So we have to remember that the combination of different effects on each of these pathways in combination with hormones really lead to some kind of clinical outcome. It's not just the hormones themselves. So some people could be low in testosterone and not have any really major deficits in mitochondrial function because they have lots of physical activity and they have lots of antioxidants in their diet and flavonoids and other things that are kind of having some effect on the mitochondrial biogenesis pathway. So it's again, a multivariate model. It's not related to just one single factor. And the mitochondria that we're talking about is mitochondria in all the different tissues in the body. These hormonal pathways impact mitochondria. They impact mitochondria in the heart. They impact mitochondria in organ systems, the thyroid, the gonads, the ovaries, the liver, the GI tract, adipose tissue. So they have these far-reaching effects. And one of the things we always look at when we look at patients that have inability to recover, like they have a chronic disease, they can't recover, they can't get better, is do they have the ability to make energy? Do they have the ability to make ATP? So like immediate issues is, are they anemic? If a patient's anemic, there's no way you're going to allow them to recover. If someone has anemia, you might as well not do anything else until you fix the anemia. Oxygen is necessary for oxidative phosphorylation. So it doesn't matter if you're dealing with a Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, you're dealing with a mood disorder, you're dealing with post-traumatic brain injury recovery, you're dealing with whatever. If they're anemic, their chance of recovery is very low until you can fix their anemia because you need oxygen to drive the oxidative phosphorylation pathways. People have dysglycemia where they just don't have the proper stable blood sugar levels to their cells. They're going to have inefficient ATP production, recovery issues. People with lots of inflammation, oxidative stress will have the same thing, but hormone deficiency is also one of the things on this list. So if someone has a hormone deficiency and they actually have very low hormone levels, their ability to recover from any kind of chronic disease is going to be an issue. Because not all the patients you're going to see that have hormone issues are going to come in with a hormonal complaint. You could have a male patient come in and they're not coming into your office with a chief complaint of, I have low libido and I have depression and I have poor muscle stamina. Like that's not even a concern for them. They have like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and can't breathe and are barely functioning. They're not even thinking about their libido because they have bigger problems. But fact is, they have these low androgens and low testosterone patterns that isn't allowing them to fully recover and optimize your health because of these insufficiencies that then have these far-reaching effects on these bioenergetic pathways that are necessary. So when you look at these biochemical charts like this, of all the different biochemical pathways, have you ever seen these cool posters that are available? You can fill a whole wall with these. But every single one of these biochemical pathways, they all need ATP to function. And ATP is so critical, mitochondrial function is so critical on hormones that when people have hormone disorders, it really has an impact on their ability to recover. So here we have different conditions, traumatic brain injury, viral infection, burn, organ disease, autoimmune disease, and we have three different scenarios, but they all have a condition. And it doesn't really matter what the condition is. If you have someone who's got lots of ATP production, healthy mitochondria, what's their outcome compared to someone who has mitochondrial failure and can't make much ATP. How much can they drive their recovery pathways? How much ability do they have to recover? So that's one of the key fundamental concepts. When you're looking at people that have hormone actual deficiencies where the hormone levels are low, it really doesn't matter if you're dealing with an autoimmune disease or an infection or some kind of injury or some kind of genetic disease. Their ability for themselves to attain homeostasis and to recover is really dependent upon their ability to produce ATP. So hormones have an impact on bioenergetic pathways directly through stimulating mitochondrial biogenesis and supporting mitophagy and clearance and making the whole fusion-fission pathway efficient. And then mitochondria also, in addition to producing energy, they're also involved with signaling pathways. And signaling pathways is related to these mitochondrial reactive oxygen species. What's important to know is that your mitochondria also produce these reactive oxygen species, they're called MROS pathways, and they actually cause stem cell proliferation, differentiation, healthy immune activation, regulation of TNF-alpha, activation of hormone signals, induction of the stress response. They're not just producing energy, they're really involved with also part of the neuroendocrine immune response. So as mitochondrial function goes down, you really start to get into a vicious cycle of going downward. The biggest clue someone has decreased mitochondrial function is they're fatigued, they're tired. The minute someone tells you they're fatigued and tired and exhausted, it's a major clue that their mitochondrial pathways are inefficient. Now, you can see hormone deficiency, mitochondrial dysfunction. Here you can have either like abnormal cortisol, melatonin, circadian rhythms, hormone deficiency, whether it's testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, T3 or T4. And then these hormone deficiencies lead to mitochondrial dysfunction. And this mitochondrial dysfunction then leads to decreased ATP output. There's less ATP output. The actual ovaries, testes, different tissues in the body's organs, liver, muscles, now don't have enough function. You get endocrine efficiency issues all throughout the system. You get abnormal mitochondric retrograde signaling pathways through those MROS pathways, and then you get this vicious cycle that's hard to get out of. And sometimes in hormone deficiency, they may actually need to take hormone replacement in order to get these systems going, this mitochondria to kick in, so they can then start to function and start to feel better. Here you can see mitochondrial dysfunction pathways impacting ATP. And when the mitochondria can't make ATP through oxidative phosphorylation pathways, they have to use a citric acid cycle, glycolytic pathways, which doesn't produce efficient amounts of ATP, so they can really only produce about 2 to 4 ATPs through those pathways. And this really causes them to burn sugar really quickly. They get into this glycolytic adrenal pathway activation and a sense of physiological stress response. They get into this, basically, this adrenal stress response pathways that impact stress resiliency pathways, and then they have a bunch of issues related to this as well. The mitochondria is a key part of it. When you look at mitochondrial functions, in addition to what hormones are necessary to allow them to function, the most important thing is physical activity. So physical activity, cognitive activity, all the things in green are really necessary for mitochondrial function. So when you're looking at a patient that can't recover, in addition to making sure they have hormones, physical activity, cognitive activity, having flavonoids, having blood sugar stability, having micronutrient density, having their chemical load reduced, having healthy sleep, having consistent circadian rhythms, even things like intermittent feeding where they have breaks in between meals, between breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and these things, those are all key to optimize this recovery pathway with chronic patients. So key concept, mitochondrial function is essential to support ATP production, to aid in healthy recovery. Hormone deficiencies can lead to mitochondrial impairment. It may be a significant clinical factor in the ability of some patients to recover from chronic conditions. So we know the mitochondria is part of this web. It could take weeks before a person takes hormones and their mitochondrial kicks back in. You can immediately change mitochondrial antioxidant activity within hours of taking certain hormones, like testosterone, estrogen, thyroid hormones, but in order to really start to get the fusion and fission and recovery, it could take some time. So this is also why some things will take some time for patients to recover and feel like they're really to recover when they take hormones. Okay, adipocytes. So we talked about adipocytes before. Now remember, adipose tissue is really part of the endocrine system. Technically, what's part of the endocrine gland or the endocrine system is the tissue that produces hormones. in the vascular system, like blood vessels are now considered part of the endocrine system because blood vessels release things like vascular growth factor, nitric oxide, and other signaling compounds. And body fat is no longer just thought of as a storage part of storage tissue for calories. Body fat is now considered part of the endocrine system because it releases many different proteins called adipokines. And these adipokines have direct impacts on modulating endocrine function. When we look at adipocytes, they produce adipokines and they also contain aromatase activity. So this is the basic concept. So adipose tissue, number one, are energy stores for metabolic demands. Number two, they have the enzyme aromatase in it that converts androgens to estrogens. And for females, this is critical to maintain their estrogen levels. About 10 to 30% of estrogen output is through these androsteroidine DHA pathways from the adrenal glands to aromatase to these estrogen outputs. It's really critical for females to have body fat like we talked about, so they have this aromatase activity. In males, this can be devastating if this aromatase activity gets turned up and they start converting the testosterone to estrogens, but this is part of adipose tissue. And then adipose tissue release different adipokines, which we'll go over the different list of different adipokines. But they basically regulate gonadotropins, FSH, LH, insulin signaling, immune modulation, and energy metabolism throughout the body. So they play this endocrine-related role in maintaining balance of male and female hormones. So let's talk about aromatization. So in females, there's the ovarian output of androgens, the adrenal output of androgens that gets converted from body fat into estradiol. And that's a normal process, right? Now, excess aromatization in females increases risk of breast cancer and gallstones and blood clots. And there are some females that genetically have increased, it's like a cytochrome P450, 182, single nucleotide polymorphism, which causes increased aromatase activity, which puts them at increased risk for gallstones or breast cancer genetically. So if they just have this increased risk, and they, in those types of scenarios, you got to make sure they can convert their estradiol to different metabolites and clear them out as efficiently as possible and so forth. And even some patients with breast cancer will have to use aromatase inhibitors to stop this progression. But you have to have some normal activity, but some genetic uniquenesses in certain conditions will cause some modulation of these pathways, like breast cancer, for example. Excess aromatization during skeletal development leads to shorter height, and that's another key factor. If you have a lot of aromatization, males or females, your growth plates stop, and then that's your height permanently. Decreased aromatization leads to decreased brain synaptic activity. Estrogens are really critical for synaptic activity for both males and females. So with males, it's pretty much the same thing. Testicular output of androgens can be aromatized to estradiol. Adrenal output of androgens to estradiol. And men need to have some estradiol too. Estrogen is really critical for brain synaptic activity. Estrogen is really important for mood activity and emotions. And just when it becomes too much, that becomes a major issue. It's a key issue for some men to develop andropause symptoms, low testosterone symptoms, if their estrogen levels are higher than their testosterone levels, okay? Now, adipocytes by themselves have metabolic activity at a slight level, but they can be expressed into a very active tissue by obesity, insulin, and things that cause inflammation, and then they further promote inflammation. So here you can see an adipocyte that's lean. Oops, it releases adiponectin. Adiponectin helps control insulin signaling, helps modulate energy metabolism. And in lean people, there's normal amounts of adipectin released. Now, with obesity, when there's increased body fat, when these adipocytes enlarge, the adiponectin levels go down, which promotes further insulin dysregulation. And then these adipocytes actually produce inflammatory mediators. So the body fat creates inflammation itself. IL-6, TNF-alpha, leptin, another adipokine called resistin, LL-37, and then these cause systemic inflammation throughout the body, and they can play a role in promoting inflammation. Now, there are different adipokines that impact hormones and metabolism. These are adipocyte-derived factors here. The list is over here. And these are adipocyte-expressed receptors where these adipokines have an effect on. And you have to see how diverse these different proteins are, and it's really, it's pretty impressive how much of an impact fat tissue can have, right? So again, it's not just storage tissue anymore. It's part of the endocrine system. And these adipocytes that release these various adipokines have been linked to all types of different conditions and related with chronic diseases. So things like osteoporosis. So the inflammatory mediator, especially like IL-6, from very active adipocytes cause bone loss. And different adipokines then promote things like sleep apnea issues and muscle atrophy and depression and migraine, and body fat itself is directly causing these types of responses. Now, when you look at the physiological expression of adipocytes, here you have a healthy response. You have a person that has healthy caloric intake, regular physical activity. Adipocytes are healthy. Immune cells release cytokines, which are immune healthy promoting, and they're releasing things like leptin to control appetite in the brain, adiponectin to stimulate the liver and pancreas, and kemerin and omanectin. These control muscle skeletal muscle and support glucose homeostasis, and that's ideal. Now, if the adipocytes get activated by excess insulin secretion from the pancreas, things that promote this like excessive caloric intake, sedentary lifestyle, they change. And then what they do is they start to release things like resist-10 and TNF-alpha and IL-6 and vasopressin. These cause immune cell inflammation and insulin resistance. So you have to also remember that like, you could have a person has more body fat, but that doesn't necessarily mean they have inflammation. But the person has more body fat has greater potential for their adipocytes to activate and cause these systemic inflammatory responses. But not everyone that has more body fat will have them. It depends on how much insulin surges they get and how much inflammatory mediators they get that turn on these pathways. It's not just an adipocyte, but it's stimulation, overactivity of an adipocyte. Inflammatory triggers like diet, training, infections, chemical pollutants, they can turn on the adipocytes, and then these adipocytes release these adipokines, and they cause systemic inflammation, promote insulin resistance, and cause havoc all throughout the system. Here, obesity activated adipocytes, and you see these adipokines involved. And these pathways in males can cause can cause hypogonadism. The adipokines released from overactive adipocytes can cause the lytic cells to fail. They can break down the testes barrier, the testes blood barrier. They can impact follicles, so the follicles undeveloped and lead to infertility and lead to estradiol imbalances in females. It can inhibit LH pathways, so the luteal phase pathways or problems to progesterone outputs are imbalanced. It can impact ovulation pathways, and it can then also promote insulin sensitivity and promote the androgens, the whole PCOS pattern. And here you can see, here for example, with insulin surges, this is one of the key ways that adipocytes are activated. And by the way, insulin surges happen in people that have insulin resistance, meaning their blood glucose, fasting glucose is high and they're in the pre-diabetic stage. But it can also happen in the hypoglycemic patient. And you have to remember with hypoglycemia, when blood sugar levels are low, the body is going to secrete cortisol and epinephrine to get blood sugar levels back up. But it's also going to have a surge of insulin to try to get that glucose into the cell. So every time a hypoglycemic has their blood sugar levels drop, they also get an insulin surge. So both insulin-resistant people have insulin surges. Insulin-resistant people have prolonged insulin surges, and functional hypoglycemic patients have insulin spikes. Okay, but they both have spikes and surges. And I'm sorry, they have surges. Hypoglycemics are more spikes, and insulin-resistant people are more prolonged. But they still have these insulin levels that are elevated, and these insulin levels that are elevated in men upregulate this aromatase enzyme, and that converts testosterone to estrogen. As men get higher levels of estrogen and they throw off their testosterone to estrogen ratio, men should be more androgen dominant and have higher levels of testosterone and estrogen. And when they lose that androgen dominance and lose this ratio, that's been shown to cause further insulin resistance. So you get this vicious cycle of aromatization in men. Now, if you have increased body fat, there's greater potential for aromatization. This pathway can get much more vicious. So this is the aromatization pathway you should be aware of. Now, in females, we get this whole PCOS pattern. And with polycystic ovarian syndrome, the classic polycystic ovarian syndrome is like an overweight female patient. And they have the insulin resistance, prediabetes pattern, diabetes pattern. But there are the atypical polycystic ovarian syndrome patients, females, that are not overweight, that are normal weight or even underweight. And what's happening with them is they're getting insulin surges promoting PCOS because of their hypoglycemia. So as their blood sugar levels drop and they get low, they get an insulin surge or insulin spike, to get their blood sugar into their cells as efficiently as they can, and they can also promote this PCOS pattern. And these normal weight, underweight, atypical PCOS syndrome patterns, as they're called in literature, they usually get overlooked in the healthcare system because the classical pattern is to be overweight. Anyways, either underweight or normal weight hypoglycemic patients, they get these insulin surge patterns that upregulates an enzyme in the thickel cells of the ovaries called 17-20 lyase. That causes testosterone DHEA levels to go up. And as women have their testosterone levels go up, that causes further insulin receptor site dysfunction, greater insulin resistance, and creates a vicious cycle. And then the greater adipocyte activity they have, the more inflammation they have, the more body fat they have, the worse this gets. So this is why, like, when someone has PCOS, as they develop more and more body fat over time, the vicious cycle gets much harder to break. Same with men. As men get aromatization issues, they get more and more body fat. The vicious cycle gets much harder to break. Okay? Key concept. Body fat increases the intensity and severity of the vicious cycle between insulin resistance and PCOS in women. Body fat mass increases the vicious cycle between insulin resistance and aromatization of testosterone into estrogen in men. Okay? Now, this is a paper that was published called Adipose Tissue Dysfunction and Obesity-Related Male Hypogonadism. Obesity is a chronic illness associated with several metabolic derangements and comorbidities, insulin resistance, leptin resistance, diabetes, and often leads to impaired testicular function and male subfertility. Several mechanisms may indeed negatively affect the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal health, such as higher testosterone conversion to estradiol by aromatase activity in the adipose tissue, increased reactive oxygen species production, and the release of several endocrine molecules affecting the hypothalamus pituitary testes axis by both direct and indirect access. And tissue expansion, body fat, decreased fat burning, increased fat storage, dysfunctional adipocytes, inflammatory mediators turning these inflammatory sites on, adipectin goes down, leptin goes up, free radicals go up. These free radicals directly come in, attack the testes, lytic cells get destroyed, testosterone levels go down, you get more insulin resistance, you gain more body fat. These adipokines then throw off the hypothalamic pituitary axis. They also disrupt FSH and LH, so you get less LH activation of the testes, and overall you end up with a male that's got hypogonadism. Very direct relationships there. This is a paper called Obesity in Male Infertility, Multifaceted Reproductive Disruption. They go on to conclude, obese men possess heavy adipose tissue depot, which home several toxins, adipokines, and other hormones, adipectin, leptin, ghrelin, orexin, apostatin. Obesity-mediated systemic disbalance in the metabolism and metabolic hormone effect of the HPG regulatory axis, and may also directly affect testicular cells despite disrupting normal function of these cells. They did this vicious cycle of obesity, increased body fat, adipokines being activated here, aromatase causing estradiol levels to go up, these adipokines suppressing FSH-LH that then lead to inability to stimulate testosterone production, low testosterone. You can see that there's even some genetic susceptibility for some people to have greater expressions with these four. And then you can see the relationships between like sleep apnea, loss of stress resiliency, inflammation. They all play a role in this pathway. Here's another study with similar things. You can see increased adipose tissue, testosterone goes down, estrogen goes up, aromatization goes up, and you get this low-grade inflammation, you get this AMP, Sertoli pathway, and you get stuck in this vicious cycle, that's this pathway here. And you might say, okay, I'll just get these men to lose weight, because they can't. They cannot do it. When they get their testosterone levels extremely low, it's not possible. And you can see these relationships here, by the way, with body fat and male hormone reproductive systems. This was a study that was looking at 50 men aged between 21 and 50 years. Other studies have shown similar relationships. But their testosterone has a linear, very clear linear relationship between their percent body fat. As the percent body fat goes up, their testosterone goes down because of all these adipocyte-related pathways here. And not so much for FSH and LH, but testosterone significantly, directly, linear relationship, negative linear relationship. We know that's the issue. And you get some of these men that are like stuck in this vicious cycle here, they have to go on testosterone. If their testosterone levels are low and they have aromatization issues, You gotta have to, once they go on some testosterone and they get their androgen levels restored, it'll be the first time in a very long time where they're able to actually break out of it. The problem is men, when they get into the stage and get into the andropause stage and luteinizing stage, they don't want help. They don't care about anything. Their spouse has to drag them in. They don't want to get these levels checked. It's changing. It's getting better now over time. But especially with the older population, different generation, they sometimes get stuck in a hole and someone's got to pull them out. And part of it is just getting these levels measured. Once your levels are measured and they're low, they can go on some bioidentical testosterone. It could be a first time in their life they're starting to see their health reversed, and their cardiovascular markers reversed, their risk for dementia reverses, blood pressure levels go down, LDL goes down, HDL goes down, HDL goes up. Like, all these things change pretty quickly with some of these people. Now their energy comes back, now they're not so tired after they work out, now they can recover, and slowly over time, they can make some change. Now it could all go downward too. They go into testosterone replacement therapy, have their aromatization issues involved, and start making estrogen and start crying and start getting emotional and get much worse. So it's not always like a perfect scenario. There's other variables we have to talk about when it comes to testosterone in men. But this vicious cycle of the adipocyte activity and testosterone is very linear, and sometimes men have to be on testosterone in order to get out of it, especially when they're deficient in testosterone. Okay, estrogens in adipose tissue in obesity-related dysfunction, and this is in women. Now let's talk about what's happening in women. So in women, it's the drop in estrogens that really leads to body fat tissue development. And they start to have metabolic issues for the first time in their life, maybe for some women in perimenopause. Some women have been dealing with PCOS their whole life, and that's a different issue. But menopause-related decline in estrogen levels are accompanied by change in adipose tissue distribution from a gyno to android and an increased prevalence of obesity in women. However, the ratio between estrogen and obesity is bidirectional. On the one hand, their deficiency leads to excessive fat accumulation and impairs adipocyte function. On the other hand, adipose tissue of obese individual is characterized by altered expression of estrogen receptors and key enzymes involved in their synthesis. If they lose their body, if they have their estrogen levels drop, they basically have an easier time getting body fat. But if they have more body fat, then they can't produce much estrogen, so they get stuck in this vicious cycle. Now, when you're looking at estrogen levels and body fat distribution in women, in menstruating females, what's really critical is their luteal phase estradiol output, second half of their cycle, how much estradiol output they have. If they have increased luteal phase estradiol output, they can have increased body fat accumulation, increased BMI, potential for insulin resistance. But in perimenopause, menopausal women, it's when their estrogen levels drop. If there's loss of inhibition to fat burning, there's increased body fat accumulation, these adipokines get activated, estrogenic receptor activity goes down, since the estrogen levels go down, estrogen levels drop, they get stuck in the vicious cycle. Just like some of these men, as they get stuck in this vicious cycle and need testosterone replacement to get out of it, same with perimenopause, menopausal women. Because there's definitely a place for endocrine replacement, hormone replacement therapy, as men and women get older and they get into these vicious cycles and they get into patterns of senescence. But you got to be very careful using these with young people. I can't tell you in my career how many stupid men I treated that were on androgens and totally disrupted their endocrine system that had years and years to recover from it. That happens all the time. Like all these guys you see that are super cut, super fit, they're taking a lot of stuff. It's just some of those things are super physiological in the early ages and that really messes them up. So we're talking about balance here. What's physiologically normal and ideal? Now, the key thing is that adipokines come up these vicious cycles, especially as men get older and females get older, with men as testosterone levels drop, as females as estrogen levels drop. As these adipocytes get activated through these hormone imbalances, they get into that metabolic syndrome, and this is where they start getting the prediabetes, the diabetes patterns, the neurodegeneration, and all those related patterns. Getting those levels checked and evaluated and treated can make a big difference for them. Now, with females that are not in menopause yet, the biggest issue is they get insulin driving andropause, androgens, they get PCOS, and they get impaired ovulation. And you can have a female patient, from the minute they hit puberty, start having menstrual cycles, start developing PCOS, and have it for the rest of her life, and then die from heart disease and dementia and Alzheimer's, because no one ever broke them out of it. That happens all the time. The current healthcare model is terrible for getting women out of PCOS, because all they're using is anti-androgens and birth control pills to try to negate some of the symptoms of it, but it's not really reversing the underlying condition itself. They might use a little bit of metformin, but it's not enough to make a big change, okay? And then, of course, major cause of infertility with obesity and so forth. you can fix a lot of infertility by just impacting the body mass index. Okay. I think we talked about this pathway before. It's just how male obesity can cause aromatase activation, inflammatory adipokines, insulin resistance patterns. But the key concepts are this. Adipocyte activity can make unwinding insulin resistance and hormone imbalances unresponsive to regular exercise and dietary strategies. At times, testosterone replacement in men or estrogen replacement in menopause can unlock the vicious cycle of insulin-driven hormone imbalances. At times, extreme clinical measures such as bariatric surgery, semaglutide, phentermine, acetamiptide, these drugs are now modulating the GIP receptors that are modulating insulin, maybe what they need to do to get their endocrine system under control to break out of that vicious cycle. But there's definitely going to be severe PCOS patterns that need very strict control. Maybe some of these anti-obesity medications that hit insulin resistance. It's definitely going to be menopausal women, perimenopausal women that may need some estrogen to break out of the vicious cycle. There's definitely going to be men that are stuck in the low androgen phase, need a little testosterone to break out of the cycle. Whether they stay on or not depends on how progressed they are, but it is a real thing. Like, you will see it all the time, and if for some of these people, it's life-changing. Understand those relationships about adipocytes and these hormones, that's important for you to do. Now, if you look at the female hormone conditions we talked about the transitions, increased adipocyte activity, obesity, impacts all the ones I highlighted, almost every single one. Every single one. Actually, PCOS should be highlighted. Male hormones, obesity impacts everything. They all impact this adipocyte activity. Now, if you look at low body mass index has a tremendous impact on endocrine function as well. So the underweight patients can be stuck in this endocrine web that they can't get out of because body fat has aromatase activity to make estrogens, but adipokines also impact the pituitary and insulin signaling pathways themselves. And here you can see adipose tissue releasing specific adipokines. These adipokines are necessary for developing follicles. The developing follicles are necessary to make estrogens. These adipokines and adipose tissue are necessary for the corpus luteum to put out progesterone. Developing the follicle make estrogen and developing progesterone is required is based on some adipose tissue. That's why when, like, you see some women that get too lean, they don't have cycles anymore. They lose their menstrual cycles. Their menstrual cycles become irregular. Women who overtrain, people that don't have enough protein, have enough fat. You add a combination of, let me tell you a hole, a vicious hole. Vegan, underweight, hypoglycemic, not enough protein, not enough fat, not enough saturated fat, not enough diverse essential fatty acids. Like, that scenario I'm telling you happens all the time. I guarantee you will have those patients walk into your office at some point in your career. And then they come in with bags full of supplements. Go, I don't know what to take. I don't know what to do. You're like, just don't do any of that. Let's get your body mass index up. What do you like to eat? Let's try to get you to eat some food. And I just can't do it. Like, you have to. Your whole endocrine system is counting on you to eat a ribeye or get some fat and protein into your system. You've got to do something. You can't just do what you're doing. Your body has certain requirements. It needs certain fats and proteins and tissues to work. You will see a lot of these really complex patients that are really not that complex. It's just a matter of their adipokine system being overlooked in the web. So adipose tissue also has a direct impact on dopamine levels in the brain, and adipocytes here, like leptin, activate the hypothalamic pituitary axis. They fire the dopaminergic neurons, which are really critical for releasing dopamine, which then activates LH and FSH release for the pituitary system as well. And then here you can see steroid hormones. Here you can see hormones being made in body fat itself. Androsteroidione, DHEA, typically produced by the adrenal glands, are going to go into body fat and then they get converted to estradiol and even some testosterone in tissue. It's a critical part of the endocrine system. Okay. When females have low body mass index, pretty much all these major issues can be impacted too that are highlighted. So, and in males, many of them can be impacted as well. Okay. So this is a paper that was published, Adipokines, Modulation of Reproductive Function. Adipokines signal the energy level of the body to the hypothalamus, which accordingly controls various physiological activities, such as the onset of puberty estrous behavior, meaning making estrogens, follicular development, sperm motility, and capacitation. That's just the ability of sperm to be able to cause implantation in the endometrium. And when you have someone with a low caloric intake, they get into starvation, physiologically catabolic state, decreased dopamine to activate the hypothalamic pathways, decreased FSH, decreased LH, you get a menstrual disorder easily that way. Malabsorption syndromes, same thing as low caloric intake, not enough demands to produce their system, decreased adipokines, impact the immune system, the endocrine system, neurological systems. Key concept. Normalizing hormone imbalances in a patient with low BMI may be difficult until they can gain a normal percentage of body fat. That might be your initial goal. We'll go over case studies tomorrow, but one of the case studies you'll see is with a patient, and you'll see she's been through multiple endocrinologists and multiple treatments by functional medicine approaches, and we just had to get her BMI up. And once we got that, everything changed. And actually, if you've been following the clinical mastership program where we have cases that we have you follow through and watch over a two-year period of actual real patients being worked up and then being monitored throughout the next 2 years, you'll see some of those patients had dramatic impacts on their endocrine function only when there's modulation to their low or high BMI responses. And it wasn't really about this magic nutraceutical protocol that made a difference for them. Okay. Lower high body mass index can impact hormone disorders and so forth. And females impacts the pituitary feedback loop. In males, they increase adipokines, cause serotonin cell inflammation, addition, and aromatization, which can cause some problems. Okay, now let's move on from mitochondria and adipocytes to the adrenal glands. Okay, the adrenal glands, as we all know, make things like cortisol, aldosterone, norepinephrine. But they also make DHEA, which is a precursor to estrogens, progesterone, testosterone. These get converted in body fat in the liver. They actually make estrogens also. And then androsteroid 9 is converted to testosterone and estrogen in body fat and in the liver. And then actual testosterone. So 10 to 30% of reproductive hormones in males and females are synthesized by the adrenal glands. So the adrenal glands typically get overlooked, but they're a major compensator for hormone imbalances that take place in both males and females. Now, the interaction between inefficient menstruation and adrenal function. Let's say you have someone who's got inefficient follicular output of estradiol. So the feedback loop's not working well, estrogen levels are dropping, progesterone levels are dropping, so that inefficient coprocyteme output of progesterone, and a normal healthy response, whether it's an abnormal menstrual cycle or perimenopause shifts, the adrenal glands can compensate for variation of estradiol output and progesterone output and then improve menstrual cycle estradiol and progesterone levels and compensate for it. So this is why it's so critical to have healthy adrenal gland function. Going into perimenopause is so healthy to have healthy adrenal function when you have someone who's got some kind of menstrual cycle abnormality. So the ovaries and adrenal glands synthesize testosterone without major spikes in the follicular, mid-cycle, and luteal phases. So just so you guys know, like when you ever look at testosterone in a female throughout the cycle, it's pretty much stable all throughout. In a menstrual cycle, the female estradiol is high in the first half, progesterone is high in the second half. And these different shifts of coordination can be imbalanced at some times, but the adrenal glands can come in and kind of balance that out. Here's how important this is in perimenopause. And one of the reasons why some women totally suffer and fall apart in perimenopause and have lots of hot flashes and vasomotor symptoms and some people don't, is directly related to their adrenal gland resiliency and the reserves and the ability to compensate. So perimenopause, loss of pituitary ovarian feedback loop function. So you get fluctuations of estrogen and progesterone as this thing's happening. And if the adrenal glands can compensate for fluctuating estrogen and progesterone levels, they can reduce the estrogen and progesterone spikes, and the patient may have no vasomotor imbalances and transition to perimenopause without really many symptoms. And if you're looking at a patient about to go into perimenopause, check their adrenal profile, make sure the adrenal glands are healthy as possible, make sure they understand blood sugar stability so there's no stress on their adrenal glands, and that really is the key area to focus on. Now, you should also know that in some people that never had adrenal problems before, as they go into perimenopause and lose their pituitary ovarian feedback loop, perimenopause itself activates the adrenal glands, puts a lot of stress on them. Now they start to get insulin resistance development, hypoglycemia, altered aldosterone levels, which then leads to luminal corticoid imbalances. So they can get dehydration tendencies, swelling and fluid retention, salt cravings. Their insulin resistance causes them to have like fatigue after meals, sugar cravings, hypoglycemia, causes them to have shakiness, irritability between meals. They may have never had these symptoms before. If they get into perimenopause, their adrenal glands are working overtime to really help balance out the reproductive hormones. There may be some inefficiency in the system, and all of a sudden, their blood sugar imbalances can be provoked much, much more easily. So if they skip a meal, now they're really sensitive to it. If they eat too much carbs, they're really sensitive to it. And they have to really watch those things. So you're always going to be looking at patients with perimenopause, what's happening with their adrenal gland function, what's the reserve like, are they starting to develop blood sugar symptoms, they go into perimenopause, again, any sign of mineral corticoid imbalance symptoms going to perimenopause. Then the focus would be to really support their adrenal glands with nutraceuticals and then proper sleep, proper rest, and then key thing, blood sugar stability. Interactions between low testosterone in males and adrenal function. So impaired adrenal function has inability to compensate for testicular output of testosterone. So normally when you look at like primary hypogonadism, secondary hypogonadism, they have low testosterone. Same thing here. The adrenal glands can raise testosterone levels by 10 to 20%. Again, if testosterone levels improved for these impairments. But if the adrenal glands are impaired, there's inability to compensate for these testicular outputs of testosterone. I'm showing. If there's some integrity here, then the system becomes balanced out. Adrenal gland resiliency is a key factor in the web of balancing out hormones. The interaction of adrenal gland function with endocrine imbalances. And this scenario here, like everything's ideal. Healthy sleep, healthy diet, healthy relationships, regular exercise, good nutrition, sense of purpose in life, work-life balance, healthy adrenal glands, adrenal gland adaptation to endocrine challenges take place, whether they go into perimenopause or have inefficient menstrual cycles or male hormone imbalances, adrenal glands are there to take up the slack. Adrenal glands maintain function with endocrine challenges. Adrenal glands cannot compensate and function after challenges, so they're like ready to do what they need to do, and they're ready to go. Okay. Now, if you have poor sleep, unhealthy diet, unhealthy relationships, lack of exercise, poor nutrition, no sense of purpose, work-life imbalances, get healthy adrenal, unhealthy adrenal functions, then things like perimenopause and male hormone imbalances hit. There's just inability to compensate for these imbalances. And then there's progression of adrenal gland dysfunction. Okay. Now, there's many types of adrenal gland imbalances. People may not have what's called a cortisol awakening response. That first 20 minutes when someone wakes up, the cortisol level should be up. That's a really key thing. The typical symptoms when they have adrenal gland imbalances are like they can't get out of bed in the morning. They have to use coffee or immediately smoke a cigarette, get some nicotine in their system to function. They get up altered cortisol circadian rhythms throughout the day. Cortisol level should be high in the morning, low at night. So if they have fluctuating energy levels throughout the day, they crash a certain part of the day or have energy a certain part of the day, those are indications of an altered cortisol rhythm. If their cortisol levels aren't going down at night, they can't fall asleep. If their cortisol levels are going up in the middle of the night, they can wake up. And then if the elevated cortisol leads to like insulin resistance, they get weight gain, moon face swelling, insulin resistance, fatigue after meals, intestinal permeability. And then if they have low cortisol, they have a tendency towards hypoglycemia, so they have to eat all the time frequently, or they get shaky, lightheaded, irritable, weak immune system, increased inflammation. These are all the patterns of adrenal gland imbalances that need to be restored in order to have the adrenal glands compensate for these types of imbalances. And then remember, with the whole stress response in the adrenal glands, it really depends upon resiliency. If a person has lost their ability to have resiliency and the person has their adrenal glands go into a stress response, which takes away from them the ability to produce testosterone and estrogen and DHEA to help them compensate for hormonal imbalances, those stress responses can further aggravate their condition by having things like ACTH and cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine patterns really suppress FSH, LH, TSH, and so forth. Another key phenomenon that takes place with elevated stress responses is this pregnenolone pathway. And there's only so much pregnenolone to go on throughout the day, and this can shift into cortisol. And they used to call this the pregnenolone steal, and they used to be, one of the theories of why when people go into stress responses, their estradiol and progesterone levels and DHEA levels drop, was there's not enough pregnenolone to go into these other metabolites. It's all going to cortisol, and that was called the pregnenolone steal pathway. And that's still a theoretical model. And there was, I think, some guy that once wrote an article oh, no one's ever shown any evidence of the pregnenolone steel pathway. And it's, of course not. How are you going to show that? You're going to stick a needle into someone's adrenal glands and their stress response to see which pathways are happening? You can't actually show that. It's a theoretical model based on clinical observation. The bottom line being is whether it's actually a pregnenolone steel or not, other times of stress, as cortisol levels go up, there is a tendency to have these other reproductive hormones go down. Now, some of that is clearly FSH and LH suppression, and some of it may be these shifts that are taking place within the gland itself as well. But it is a phenomenon of stress response. As these stress hormone pathways like cortisol go up, some of these reproductive hormones tend to go down. Now, with unadapted stress responses, the other thing that happens is the aldosterone levels become depleted under the stress response, so they're unable to retain sodium. It's really common to people to see reduced blood pressure dropping, salt cravings, abnormal perspiration, difficulty staying hydrated, frequent urination. And then as their blood pressure gets reduced, there's not enough tissue perfusion, getting blood to their hands. They get cold hands, cold feet, poor brain endurance, hair falls out. So they're really exhausted, low body mass index patient that then has a stress response. And they have no adrenal reserves. It's really common to see them suffer for all these symptoms and then have the inability to compensate for these hormonal shifts. And then here you can see the cortisol responses here with, if someone has a non-adapted stress response, for some people, their cortisol levels go down. They have a tendency to hypoglycemic patterns. Remember, cortisol is there to break down glycogen to glucose through gluconeogenesis. As people get their cortisol levels depleted, they lose the efficiency to get their blood sugar levels back up, and they get a tendency to get into a hypoglycemic state. For other people, they get their cortisol levels that are elevated. They basically get insulin receptor sensitivity, and they get fatigue after eating, and they get towards insulin resistance patterns. And then when people get into non-adapted stress responses, their cortisol levels go down. They get into this hypoglycemic state. At nighttime, they get nocturnal hypoglycemia. So they have the inability to stay asleep. And if their cortisol levels are high, they lose the ability to fall asleep. These non-adapted stress responses also impact thyroid function. They can suppress TSH, cause a primary pituitary, secondary hypothyroid pattern. They can downregulate 5-deiodinase, which will decrease T3, reverse T3, and increase reverse T3, and develop hypothyroid symptoms, even though they're not actually thyroid, hypothyroid. Okay, and this is just the summary of the main pathways that impact non-adapted stress responses, neurochemical imbalances, low TSH, conversion issues, insomnia, bone density loss. And the key concept here is non-adapted stress responses occur when individuals lose their stress resiliency. Non-adapted stress responses can lead to suppression of LH, FSH, and TSH. They can lead to hormone imbalances. Non-adapted stress responses can promote underconversion of T4 into T3. The non-adapted stress responses can promote dysglycemia, which can promote hormone imbalances itself. So dysglycemia and adrenal gland imbalances are a big part of this web, and they're intimately related to dysglycemia. We talked about dysglycemia at the very end of the last section, but I want to go into it with a little bit more detail. The two main categories of blood sugar balances are hypoglycemia and insulin resistance. And normally, blood sugar levels are in a green range here. With hypoglycemia, like a person may have their blood sugar levels drop throughout the day, then they eat a meal, and then it spikes up a little bit. They get a little bit of maybe an insulin surge a little bit here, and they drop back down. So that's like a common response. And with insulin resistance, their insulin receptor sites are not allowing glucose to get into the cell. So their glucose levels are high all throughout the day. And sometimes they eat and they have increased surge of insulin because their body can't regulate their insulin outputs properly. And then they may actually eat something and have their blood sugar drop and get shaky, lightheaded, and irritable. So you have to realize there's a little bit of hypoglycemia with insulin resistance people when they surge out insulin. And then with some hypoglycemic patients, as they first eat, they get a little bit of like insulin surges as well. So it's like a little bit of a roller coaster ride that they have. And either way, these blood sugar imbalances can lead to hormone imbalances. And if someone has hypoglycemia or insulin resistance, you can never fix the adrenal glands. And if someone has hypoglycemia insulin resistance, you can never really fix stress resiliency issues. So this becomes a central part of the web that you have to address when it comes to imbalances. Now, things like perimenopause can activate the adrenal glands and then promote these blood sugar imbalances, so it can go one part of the web, can push one way, or it can go back the other way. As people get hypoglycemia and insulin resistance patterns, they fatigue their adrenal glands. So when they get to perimenopause, they don't have the adaptation there, and that can create its own problems as well. So typical hypoglycemic lifestyle is just basically missing meals, eating high sugary type foods. They crave sweets. They get lightheaded if meals are missed. And they have all types of fatigue, insomnia, depression, and mood disorder symptoms. People have insulin resistance, just have lack of physical activity. They overeat. They have high sugar diets, high carbs, not enough fiber. They get really tired after they eat. They crave sugar after they eat. And they get depression, mood disorders, hormonal imbalances, and fatigue. One of the clinical pearls we talked about earlier was the most important clinical question to ask to determine if a patient has underlying blood sugar imbalances: do you experience any change in your energy or function after you eat? Now remember, in a normal response, someone wakes up in the morning, they feel rested, they have energy, wake up with an appetite, they eat a meal, but they don't have any sugar cravings afterwards. There's no change in function between meals. Once they eat, they're not tired, they're just not hungry anymore. Okay? And they get no change in energy or function back when they eat. Hypoglycemics, they wake up with difficulty, they don't have any appetite in the morning, and they consume caffeine or sugar for breakfast. They lose function between meals. They get energy after they eat. That's a key thing with hypoglycemics. And their function comes back after they eat. They crash around 3 to 5 o'clock. They have difficulty staying asleep throughout the night because they get nocturnal hypoglycemia. With insulin resistance people, they wake up not feeling rested or recovered. They wake up with sugar cravings. They eat a sugar. They usually eat a high sugar and high starch breakfast. And then they get tired after they eat. They crash after lunch. They need stimulants like coffee to function throughout the day. And there can also be some intermingled hypoglycemia insulin resistance patterns with some people. Remember that these hypoglycemia insulin-related patterns to adipocyte activity can cause the whole PCOS pattern in females and this whole aromatization pattern in males. So those are the two main things you want to look for. Because the minute you see a female patient with any kind of hormone imbalance or infertility, you look for signs of insulin resistance. Levels high, glucose high, triglycerides higher than cholesterol. You see they fatigue after meals. Go right there. You can be very efficient in figuring out what's going on with their hormone system. With males, the minute like depression, a lot of emotional issues, lack of motivation, lack of drive, lack of recovery, lack of libido, I mean, that they're pre-diabetic, their blood sugar levels are high, boom, immediately go into aromatization. They're probably converting the testosterone to estrogens. They're probably having low androgen production from their metabolic pathways. You always want to look for these metabolic syndrome patterns. Blood pressure, so the diagnosis of metabolic syndrome, the criteria are, this is the pre-diabetes stage. If you have three of the following symptoms patterns: blood pressure higher than 130, over 85, fasting blood sugar over 100, waist larger than 40 inches for men or 35 inches for women, HDL cholesterol under 40 for men or under 30, triglycerides over 150. With early stages of people sometimes, like you have early PCOS with a female patient that's normal body weight and athletic, and you'll have to do like a postprandial glucose test where you have them take baseline glucose, then they take a glucose insulin drink, predetermined amount of fructose in there, and then boom, they check their glucose, insulin, and glucose levels an hour later, 2 hours later, 3 hours later, depending how you order the test. And then you'll see a lot of these people have this postprandial dysglycemia pattern, and they really have this hidden dysglycemia type pattern. I'm going to show you a case study like that. And then as people start to get into early patterns of insulin resistance, you'll start to see their glucose above 100. You start to see their triglycerides high. And then as they get into metabolic syndrome, that's when they start to have glucose that's elevated but not in the diabetic range yet. Their triglycerides are high. The lipid panel goes the wrong way. Total cholesterol, LDL go up. HDL goes down. The uric acid may even go up. Their triglycerides are definitely higher than the total cholesterol. They eventually get to diabetes. The minute you see a male or female hormone imbalance that has blood glucose patterns, that's your goal. Don't go anywhere else. You're going to waste time. You really need to fix that. So here you see the expression of metabolic syndrome in males and females. With women, they get insulin resistance. Estrogen goes down, testosterone goes up, adipocyte cell activity is there, body fat accumulation, vicious cycle. With men, insulin resistance patterns, estrogen goes up, testosterone goes down, just the opposite. Adipocyte cell activity, body fat accumulation. So this is something we talked about earlier, but let me go into this in more detail. Three principles for stabilizing blood glucose levels. Number one, the patient must eat frequently enough to prevent drops in blood glucose, okay? Anytime a person says that they feel energized or back to normal after eating, that's a sign that their blood sugar levels were low. Okay. The patient, what you want to make sure the patient has, if the goals are achieved, is when they eat, they don't feel like their injury comes back. If they feel like their injury is coming back, that means they've gone too far with, too long for their physiology to go without food. So they have to eat frequently enough to not feel like their injury is coming back. They just feel like they're not hungry anymore. And then they also need to make sure that their blood sugar levels aren't dropping. So if they get any symptoms of shakiness, irritability, lightheadedness, that's a sign that the blood sugar levels are dropping. One of the key things you want to teach your patients to fix their adrenal glands, to get their blood sugar levels stable, to break them out of this web, is you can't let your blood sugar levels drop. So what that means to you is if you eat and you feel better, that's a sign you went too long. If you're crashing, getting lightheaded and shaky between meals, that means your blood sugar has dropped already. You need to eat more frequently and have maybe even higher sources of protein and fat with your meals to prevent these drops in blood sugar. Okay. The second principle is the patient must avoid insulin surges after meals. So what that means is the patient does not feel fatigued after eating. A big clue that they just had too much food intake, too much load for their body after they eat, is they just get really tired. They need to take a nap. They need to close their eyes after they eat. That means the mass of food they had, even if it was low carbohydrates, was too much for their system. Now, if it was carbohydrates, maybe they need to lower the carbohydrate load for that meal. But the simple fact of feeling tired after the eating is a sign that they're having an insulin surge. Okay? Because if glucose can't get into the cell, glucose has to get stored in triglycerides. And glucose going to triglycerides demands a lot of ATP and energy. So it makes the person fatigued and tired. And then the other key thing is the patient doesn't have sugar craving after they eat. Another big clue of insulin resistance is they eat and they have to have something sweet. That needs to be controlled. So again, the meal intake, the amount of carbs they have, the total content of the meal, the mass of the meal, has to be adjusted so they don't have sugar cravings after they eat or feel tired. They can't let their blood sugar levels drop. And the third thing is the patient must have enough glycogen to supply the body and brain with fuel through its sleeping. It's also critical that the patient is able to sleep through the night without waking up in the middle of the night. A lot of times when people don't have enough, miss too many meals or have simple sugars, they don't have enough glycogen buildup. When a person goes to sleep, they use about 60% of their glycogen reserves. But if they don't have the glycogen there, then the adrenal glands release epinephrine and norepinephrine. That wakes them up, and that can lead to some problems. Key concept. Insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome promotes PCOS in females and aromatization of testosterone in males. Insulin resistance promotes increased body fat, which can promote abnormal adipokine release and disrupt hormone metabolism. Chronic hypoglycemia lifestyle leads to adrenal gland depletion and impaired adrenal gland resilience to adapt to fluctuating reproductive hormones. Okay, so let's go on from this adrenal gland dysglycemia pattern into the microbiome. The microbiome is critical because, first of all, it contains phase 1, phase 2 biotransformation enzymes. Those are important to not only reduce toxic load and chemicals, but they convert hormones to other metabolites that can be used to bind to receptors and also to clear hormones out. Bacteria have the ability to metabolize botanicals and flavonoids into active compounds, especially different flavonoids like soy flavonoids get converted into the gut into E. coli and enterolactone, which then have effects on estrogen receptor modulators. So you need to have gut bacteria to convert dietary flavonoids into compounds that can actually bind to endocrine receptors. Bacteria have the ability to manage metabolic modulation of energy. There's lots of strong intimate relationships between the microbiome and short-chain fatty acid production and G-coupled proteins that are involved with insulin regulation. We talked about that in the diabetes cross-institute course. Gut bacteria-induced post-transitional modifications. This includes endocrine receptor functions. Gut bacteria metabolize hormones. Gut bacteria have the ability to develop cellular messenger pathways that are involved with neuroimmune modulation. So there's different gut messenger proteins in the gut that impact hypothalamic pituitary integrity like ghrelin and so forth. Now, this shows this intimate relationship between the ovaries and the adrenal glands and even body fat making estrogens. Estrogens like E2, E1, E3, they get synthesized, they get metabolized into what are called 2,4-16 hydroxymetabolites. These are different versions of estrogens. Some of these go into circulation, have impacts on receptor sites. Some of these get metabolized out of the body completely by liver detoxification pathways. These hormones that are metabolized get released into bile, so you have to have gallbladder contraction of bile to get them into the circulation into the gut for elimination and clearance. And then here you can see different gut bacteria. They can metabolize estrogens. They can metabolize dietary estrogens. And then they have this feedback loop cycle back. And this is known in the literature as the estrobolome, where these integrated pathways between microbiome bacteria and production of hormones. So this is, the system is really critical. And the key thing about the system is diversity. You have to have microbiome diversity. Now, one of the things we see happen in the literature with PCOS is when people have a high fat, low fiber diet, insulin resistance, they lose their diversity. They get intestinal permeability. They get endotoxemia, where they have a gram-negative bacteria, polysaccharides like LPS, get into their system, cause inflammation. And those things promote PCOS. One part of the vicious cycle of PCOS is this high fat, low fiber, high sugar, insulin pattern that then promotes gut dysfunction, which then promotes PCOS. So you can't just treat PCOS at the insulin receptor site level with metformin or some things like that. You have to treat the microbiome as well. These become really critical. There's crosstalk between the gut and PCOS. This was a really good paper, review paper, if you want to read it, in the Journal of Ovarian Research. They talk about how the microbiota is communicating with inflammatory messengers and insulin resistance pathways and androgenic pathways and PCOS mechanisms, all interrelated, but the microbiota is an overlooked area of PCOS. And here's another paper showing how different gut metabolite markers like ghrelin, GLP-1, CCK, PPY, all impact energy production and insulin regulation and inflammation, but they're all involved in PCOS. So when you're dealing with PCOS, you can't just treat insulin resistance. And this is the problem we have. Like when you look at the current model, PCOS, it's okay, take metformin, that'll control insulin resistance. We don't really care about the microbiome. Take an androgen blocker. Okay, and all contraceptives to avoid any fluctuation of hormones. That's not going to fix and change this pattern. Okay. Now, the key pathway with the gut part of the web is when people have dysbiosis, they have unhealthy gut bacteria populations because they have a diet that's low in fiber and high in sugar. The bacteria that are produced in an environment with high sugar and high fat have high amounts of this enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. And when the liver does this job of detoxifying hormones from a fat-soluble state to a water-soluble state by attaching glucuronic acid, these beta-glucuronidase enzymes in the microbiome in dysbiosis take off that conjugated glucuronic acid, and the hormone goes back into circulation and can compete with other hormones. It can have an effect. It cannot be cleared out. And it just allows the body to not clear out hormones efficiently. This is why dysbiosis is a major concern when you have people that have hormone overload issues or they have adverse effects of taking hormones, because it really sabotages hormone detoxification pathways. Here you can see leaky gut. This is something we talked about in the Crosby Institute GI course, as we talked about all different mechanisms that impact leaky gut. But lack of any hormone, thyroid hormones, progesterone, estradiol, testosterone, is going to make it very difficult to regenerate the lining of the gut. And also stress hormones that are elevated are going to cause breakdown of the gut barrier. When you have someone who's got deficiency of these thyroid hormones, they have diminished ability to dampen intestinal inflammation. These have anti-inflammatory effects in the gut. And they have decreased ability to support regeneration of intestinal lining, right? Hormone deficiencies make it very difficult to restore leaky gut patterns. And then with leaky gut, if they get leaky gut for whatever the reason may be, it may not be related to hormone deficiency, it may be related to an infection or taking corticosteroids or antibiotics or being diabetic or whatever the case may be. But if someone gets leaky gut and they have dysbiosis and then that polysaccharide from gram-negative bacteria gets released into the bloodstream, this is called endotoxemia. And endotoxemia further perpetuates things like PCOS and metabolic syndrome. Lots of studies have shown this relationship between leaky gut promotion with PCOS and then endotoxemia making PCOS much, much worse. And it also affects other endocrine functions as well, like follicular development and hormone secretion and even things like menopause transition. So this is the paper that was published called Gut Permeability, Inflammation, and Bone Density Across Menopause Transition. Gut permeability increases during menopause transition because estrogen levels drop. Greater gut permeability is associated with more inflammation and lower bone mineral density. So here you can see in this paper, they show the gut microbiota, when there's intestinal permeability type patterns, these shifts take place that then shift into altered bone metabolism that then lead to osteoporosis and systemic inflammation in the gut. The liver is producing hormones. It gets released in the bile to the gut. This is through the gallbladder conjugation pathways. And the proper estrogen metabolites are supposed to take place here. And then these systems go back. So having healthy tight junctions, having healthy microbiome diversity, having healthy gallbladder function are all critical for normal estrogen circulation and function. And then here you can see changes in the microbiome diversity in menopause alone. So there's this is looking at concentrations of hormone, of different bacterial concentrations, populations, premenopause, menopause transition, postmenopause. Look at the change in bacterial species. Significant. So this is important too, because hormones change the microbiome. So yeah, many people that start to have leaky gut development, food sensitivities, imbalances, if their menopausal transition leads to a significant drop of hormones. So if their adrenal glands are healthy before, they can adapt to those changes, they can have a smooth transition. And if they have senescence and they can't compensate themselves, then estrogen replacement may be one of the things that helps them recover and restore their health. Okay, this is a paper called The Menstrual Cycle may not be limited to endometrium, but also may impact gut permeability. During the menstrual cycle, there are highly significant changes in the load of gut commensal gram-negative bacteria in the serum with peaks in the end of the cycle. Increased loads of gut commensal gram-negative bacteria at the end of the menstrual cycle is associated with premenstrual syndromes, including fatigue, psychosomatic anxiety symptoms, breast swelling, and food cravings. So in this study, what they showed is that when it's altering menstrual cycle function, that actually changes the microbiome, and these changes in bacteria in the microbiome are directly associated with PMS symptoms, psychosomatic and tissue swelling and fatigue and pain and food cravings and so forth. So very interesting. This was another study that was really looking at associations between adiposity, endotoxin exposure, inflammation, and testosterone concentrations. And basically, they found that if they administered a low dose in their toxin, like leaky gut, they could see a significant drop in testosterone levels. So there was also the study showed that short bursts of endotoxin exposure can reduce testosterone production within 30% within 6 hours of exposure. So someone has leaky gut, male or female, that does have a direct impact on their endocrine function. That's so important to remember, but hormone imbalances can also then cause leaky guts. So you have this vicious cycle. So you got to look for it, and if you see it, you need to fix it. And this is a study where they illustrate bad inflammatory diets causing leaky gut, causing inflammation, the inflammation shutting down testes, testosterone production, and then creating this vicious cycle where these testicular cells are injured from this leaky gut pattern, not making testosterone. And here you can see a study where they looked at a relationship between LPS, which is from leaky gut, and they looked at LPS binding protein, LBP, and you can see, for example, testosterone levels and leaky gut protein. So as their testosterone levels, as they develop leaky gut, you can see testosterone levels dropping in a very linear fashion that way. As they developed higher inflammation, IL-6, their leaky gut patterns got worse. As inflammation went up, testosterone levels went down, pretty routine patterns. And here we exposed men to low levels of LPS, which you can get from leaky gut. You can see their endotoxin group is the one with the circle dots, placebo is white. But you can see IL-6 levels jumping up compared to controls when they give a little of LPS into their system like you can get from leaky gut here with TNF-alpha. And then you can see here with the endotoxin group, testosterone levels plummeting as soon as they get some LPS into their system. LH levels plummeting, FSH levels also plummeting with some of that. There's this vicious cycle between dysbiosis, leaky gut, and hormone function is very real. And these things can't be ignored. And sometimes you have to treat the gut dysbiosis at the same time you're working on hormones. And sometimes you can't fix leaky gut until they take hormones. Sometimes you have to fix leaky gut before they even respond to hormones. Sometimes you have to do both at the same time. But these are the realities of practice. Okay, so let's move on to key concepts here. Microbiome disturbances can lead to altered hormone biotransformation into secondary metabolites and biotransformation for hormone clearance. So you've got to have healthy bacteria to clear out metabolites and hormones and get them out of the system. Microbiome dysbiosis can alter insulin signaling pathways and promote obesity and PCOS. You can't overlook microbiome integrity, leaky gut with patients that have PCOS or like males that have this like high testosterone, high estrogen pattern. Microbiome dysbiosis can lead to intestinal permeability and toxemia. You're going to see lots of young men that have very low testosterone because they have like celiac disease and they eat gluten and dairy all the time, and the testosterone levels plummet. Until you fix that, it can't change. That's not going to be uncommon. Endotoxemia may promote systemic inflammation. That's the whole leaky gut pattern. That's why it's really critical, because when you look at lab tests, you don't just look at occludin zonulin, but you look at LPS. We went over that in a lot of detail in the Crossing Institute GI course. The difference between leaky gut and leaky gut with endotoxemia. And if you guys are following all our courses in the Crossing Institute, you can realize they all kind of work together. They're all pieces of the puzzle. We can't explain each chapter of the story with each course, but as we start to fill them in, as we get to our 200-hour completion of all the 18 courses, you can see the big picture of where all these steps in. Dysglycemia, of course, we can really go into these pathways more, but in the hormone course, we got to really talk about the FSH-LH pathways more and so forth. Okay, now, the thyroid gland. Simply put, every single hormone imbalance that a male or female can be caused by hypothyroidism. Or say it differently. You have to always rule out hypothyroidism, like high TSH, the actual full-blown real hypothyroidism, high TSH, anytime you see a male or female at any age with any kind of endocrine disorder. Because thyroid hormones directly impact the entire endocrine system, and they impact the metabolic rate of testes and ovaries. Any states of hypothyroidism is going to cause everything to fail, and you have to make sure they're not hypothyroid. Okay? In this scenario, it's like Hashimoto's hypothyroidism. The key point, though, it's just like hypothyroidism. Hashimoto just happens to be the number one cause of hypothyroidism. But if you're actually hypothyroid and their T4, T3 levels are down, they're not going to be able to get their lytic cells to respond to LH. They're going to have immediate breakdown of the testicular barrier. You need thyroid hormones to maintain that barrier. They're going to have immediate impaired metabolism and fat mass development and increased aromatization. Their whole testosterone production is down. So if you see a male with all these andropause patterns, you have to make sure they're not hypothyroid. You can be wasting a lot of time. That needs to be addressed. And then male fertility, same thing. Any type of poor semen quality, poor semen motility, low sperm count, any kind of erectile dysfunction, any kind of low libido, you've got to rule out hypothyroid issues. And then when you look at any type of dysmenorrhea, any kind of abnormal menstrual cycles, infertility, miscarriages, you've got to look at hypothyroidism. Like thyroid hormones are necessary for FSH release. They're necessary for the receptors on the ovarian tissue to respond to FSH. They're critical for LH releases. So if female has hypothyroidism, all types of female menstrual irregularities are possible. And then anytime you see any type of infertility in a female with fertilization issues, immune implantation issues, miscarriages, preterm low birth weight, lack of failure with IVF therapy, you got to make sure hypothyroid has been ruled out, which is typically done. And hypothyroidism can actually promote all types of dysglycemia, hypoglycemia, insulin resistance. So every single metabolic profile should include a thyroid workup. Always. At the very least, a TSH to make sure they're not clearly in hypothyroid. Okay? Now, key concepts. Hypothyroidism can promote male and female hormone disorders. Any abnormal male or female endocrine dysfunction at any age must have hypothyroidism ruled out by measuring serum TSH levels. Now listen, like people can have T4 or conversion issues or binding globulin issues and all those things. Those can also have somatosubtle effects. The main one you're worried about is full-blown actual hypothyroidism, high TSH. That's a for sure mechanism you need to identify. Now let's talk about the brain. Another key issue with a lot of hormone imbalances that cause people to have mood disorders, cognitive imbalances, all types of dysfunctions. And hormone deficiencies will impact different parts of cellular functions of the brain and limbic systems. Limbic system revolve with emotions and mood. And hormones deficiencies leads to lack of functional synapses, nerve growth factors, neuron branching, and plasticity. So when you look at something that's happening throughout our entire life, is we have neurons that are connecting and developing neural networks. So the ability from, like, here you can see neural networks before some kind of training. This could be learning a cognitive task. It could be dancing. This could be anything. Over a period of time, neural pathways start to develop. That's called neuroplasticity. Neurobranching, like this, these are neurons branching around to each other, developing these connectivity patterns. These branching pathways all require hormones. They require estrogen being one of the most important ones for both males and females. They require testosterone, and they require thyroid hormones. This is an injured neuron, and here you can see a healthy neuron bypassing it, going around to connect with a healthy neuron to gain function back. So it's really critical when you're looking at this web to understand how hormones have a direct impact on synaptic activity. One of the things that happens over time is like a six-month-old doesn't have much neuroconnectivity, neuroplasticity. They have lots of neurons. Over time, they have connectivity. But as we get older, we lose some of our neuron connections and our neuron quantity. And hormones play a big role in this. And this is why hormones have a strong relationship to neurodegeneration. So men and women, what's critical for them is testosterone, estrogen, and thyroid hormones. Any one of those hormone deficiencies can accelerate protein aggregation, filler of autophagy, beta amyloid plaque development, alpha-synuclein buildups, promotion of Parkinson's disease, all the neurodegenerative diseases, and lack of neuron connectivity to compensate. So sometimes if you find a hormone deficiency, you're slowing down progression of a neurodegenerative disease if it's identified quickly and treated. Hormones have a direct impact with neurotransmitters. We talked about this in the mood course, the Crosby Institute. Here you can see the different relationships between estrogens and different neurotransmitters and progesterone, testosterone, thyroid hormones, different neurotransmitters for both males and females. So when these hormones have a direct impact on a homotropic modulation effect on dopaminergic neurons or serotonergic neurons or GABAergic neurons. So when a female is, for example, low in estrogens, their cholinergic activity may be impacted, so their memory and learning could be influenced. Their dopaminergic activity can be impacted, so they're not getting as much joy from things that used to make them happy. Very strong relationships between hormones and mood and neurotransmitter activity. We also know that menstrual cycle abnormalities can alter brain neurochemistry. Things like insulin resistance, hypoglycemia causing insulin surges, promoting PCOS, testosterone levels spike up. That can alter neurochemistry in the brain, cause mood disorders. Chronic stress or hypocaloric diet or overtraining activate the ACTH stress response. That can suppress FSH and LH. That can lead to lack of ovulation, follicle maturity, cause amenorrhea. That can alter neurochemistry levels in the brain, cause mood disorders. Here you can see things like lack of sleep, unhealthy lifestyle, high stress, overtraining, malnutrition, impaired ovarian pituitary feedback loop. This can cause abnormal surges of FSH and LH and cause alterations of neurochemicals as well. Now, the other thing that these hormone deficiencies can do is they can impact the glial system, the neuroinflammatory system in the brain, and mitochondrial function. We've already talked about that hormones impact mitochondrial function. And when there's brain impairment of mitochondrial function, people will have all types of symptoms where their brain fatigues. So the key thing with mitochondrial neuron impairment is when they use their brain, that's when they have fatigue. So when they drive, then they have fatigue. When they stand, they have fatigue. When they have writer's cramp, they have fatigue. When they have to have a cognitive response, they have fatigue. These are all signs that they may have some deficits in their neuron mitochondria. And the last part of this hormone deficiency in the brain is this microglial activation. So when you look at microglial cells, these are the immune cells in the brain. We talked a lot about these in the neuroinflammation Crosby Institute course. But M1 pathways are pro-inflammatory. M2 pathways are anti-inflammatory. And when you look at neuroinflammation, when males or females have a hormone deficiency state, this activates the glial cells into a pro-inflammatory state. And these pro-inflammatory states can uncouple neuron mitochondria. They can impact nerve conduction issues. They can activate the kininurine pathways, which impact serotonin. They can activate glial cells, cause astrocyte dysfunction, blood-brain permeability. We went into this in lots of detail in the neuroinflammation course, but mood disorders course. But you have to realize that hormone insufficiencies cause massive brain inflammation. As a matter of fact, what they're doing now in lots of studies with traumatic brain injuries is immediately after a brain injury, they're giving him progesterone, DHEA, pregnenolone, and the recovery rates from brain injury going dramatically up. And people are not dying as much after traumatic brain injuries when they're given hormones immediately after the injury. So it's having this very neuroprotective effect. And it's starting to become standard protocol in a lot of traumatic brain injury centers to immediately give hormones as someone has a brain injury to help them with the recovery anti-inflammatory phase. So, you know, you don't want to be hormone deficient and get a brain injury or get a stroke and then not be able to recover. So, key concept, hormone imbalances can disrupt the brain synaptic activity and microglial activity. Persistent symptoms of depression, cognitive decline, and other mood disorders may suggest ongoing neurochemical and neuroinflammatory mechanisms that should be addressed. Once the hormone levels get normalized, you still may have persistent neuroinflammation issues that need attention that way. And then what I did here, just the last part of this section here, just need a couple more minutes here, is I went through and went over the web, but then I went through the web of each part of these individually. So let's go over these one by one. So when you look at mitochondria, adipocytes, adrenal glands, dysglycemia, microbiome imbalances, thyroid glands, and brain, and look at abnormal puberty, which we'll get into in much more detail. With abnormal puberty, there's a few things that happen. The main cause of abnormal puberty is increased body fat storage, obesity, and endocrine disrupting chemicals. And with abnormal patterns of puberty, certain medications, we'll go over that in the next section, prenatal chemical exposures, postnatal chemical exposures, these things are endocrine disrupting chemicals. They can promote obesity through obesogens. Poor diet, lack of exercise, poor sleep, they cause obesity. This direct pathway can cause gynecomastia in boys. These patterns cause dysbiosis. This impact biotransformation patterns. This can impact metabolism of hormones. This can disrupt the hypothalamic gonadal axis distribution that causes abnormal puberty timing. What you're going to see with puberty issues is like lack of body fat, too much body fat, obesity, endocrine disrupting chemicals. Those are key things that then push this web. Now, when you look at menstrual disorder imbalances, if you have a person that has dysregulated menstrual timing, their hormone fluctuations from their estradiol peaks and LH surges and luteal phase progesterone outputs can cause neurochemical disruptions like depression, anger, anxiety, mood swings, and sadness. These hormone fluctuations can then cause the adrenal glands to get activated to compensate for the estrogen progesterone issues. These adrenal gland stressors can then lead into a promotion of dysglycemia as they get challenged. They're more prone to hypoglycemia, more prone to insulin resistance. The mineralocorticoids get thrown off. They get tissue swelling and salt cravings and all types of imbalances that way. There are hormone fluctuations cause dysregulated immune functions. They get systemic inflammation. Prostaglandin imbalances form or already pre-existing that perpetuate the pattern. So they get these mood changes, chronic inflammation, blood sugar abnormalities, mineralocorticoid imbalances that are part of this web. And then as you look at perimenopause and menopause, in menopause and perimenopause, one of the things that happens is there is an inflammatory response as estrogen levels drop. And as this inflammatory response takes place, these inflammatory mediators become elevated, antioxidant reserves plummet, there's essential fatty acid imbalances that take place, there's adrenal gland compensation, the glial cells get activated towards a neuroinflammatory pattern, they get bone loss. So people that go into perimenopause, they get systemic inflammation, they gain body fat, they get neuroinflammation, they start to get blood sugar disorders, even though they're taking fatty acids, they get imbalances there, they get bone loss. We'll talk about this in more detail in the next section. If these perimenopause inflammatory pathways that are developed are not addressed, then they progress into neurogenic diseases and cardiovascular diseases and osteoporosis and sarcopenia and so forth. Then finally, with males with andropause, it's this vicious cycle between increased body fat, insulin resistance, increased thrombocyte activity, cytokine surges, and then these vicious cycles start to develop between obesity and systemic inflammation and lytic cell dysfunction and inflammatory cytokine responses and neuroinflammation and leaky gut and endotoxemia and sleep apnea, and you get these vicious cycles as well. Thank you.
You can find all of this information and more at drknews.com/podcast. There you'll find the show notes, readings, and links related to this episode. You can also find Dr. Karazian's blog at drknews.com. The best thing to do is sign up for his weekly newsletter, where he will update you on the latest research and clinical strategies related to chronic and autoimmune health conditions. On social, you can find him on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest with the username Datis Karazian. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional health care services, including the giving of medical advice. And note, no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to the podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical conditions they have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. To learn more about Dr. Karazian's disclosures and the companies he advises, please visit drknews.com/about.